From Iowa Public Radio News, this is The Exchange. I'm Alex Hoyer, in for Ben Kiefer. The recent storms in Iowa have put more than a third of Iowa's 99 counties under a state disaster proclamation. Today we find out what that means. We'll talk about the criteria and benefits of state and federal disaster declarations. We'll also get updates on damage in just two Iowa communities. We'll talk about the situation in Warren County, just south of Des Moines, and we'll check in with recovery efforts in Butler County, northwest of Waterloo. Also, stories of price gouging in Iowa during disasters and the rules against it. That's coming up on The Exchange right after this news from NPR. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer, in for Ben Kiefer today. The governor has put more than a third of Iowa's 99 counties under a state disaster proclamation. He's requested almost just as many counties be declared a presidential disaster area. So today we're talking about the criteria for disaster proclamations and what they do. And we're also getting an update from some disaster-affected communities in the state. And that's where we start with those disaster-affected communities. I'm joined now by Mahala Cox, the Emergency Management Coordinator for Warren County, which is just south of Des Moines. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Now, beginning with you, Governor Culver, as I said, has issued a disaster proclamation for counties. Warren County is included in that, and Warren County is also on a list that the governor is requesting for a presidential disaster declaration. Tell us what happened in Warren County.
Well, from June on, we just repeatedly hit by storms, you know, like every 2 days. And some of them are wind-related, some of them were water-related. So it's kind of hard to recover from some of those and get your normal day-to-day activities done as well.
Mm-hmm. Set a picture for us. How many people were impacted? Was it homeowners, business owners?
Well, homeowners are impacted by just the saturation of the groundwater. And with water in their basements and such. And we had some very heavy rains, especially in Indianola and Carlisle, that we had, you know, 4 or 5 inches in a couple hours, which, you know, the storm sewers aren't capable to take that, and so it backs up into the people's basements. So we have a lot of water, urban street flood issues, flash flooding issues.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into more of how disaster proclamations work, how it would let Warren County do something, talk to me a little bit about what kind of recovery work needs to be done in the county there.
Well, in the county itself, we have major concerns about our roads and our bridges and the wash water and how the stabilization of the bridges and just basically washing away the road surface. So Warren County has, well, I think, the third in the state amount of roads and like second in the state with the amount of bridges. So we have a lot of recovery to do in just those two infrastructure areas itself.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think that that the county would be able to benefit from state or federal resources?
Well, the state resources really benefit the citizens more than it will benefit the county, the government. There's two kinds of recovery going on, one for individuals, one for the citizens, and one for public infrastructure. So the state's proclamation basically doesn't help the citizens with a small grant process, but it is designed basically for our extremely low-income citizens, just to help them kind of get on their feet. So there isn't a lot of help for the mainstay of citizens mm-hmm. with a state proclamation. The other thing that a state the governor's proclamation gives us is assistance such as equipment or personnel from the Department of Transportation, the National Guard. For instance, we borrowed a pump for the city of Carlisle to keep their water treatment plant from going underwater and, you know, things like that. There isn't any financial help, basically, from the state for government. that's why Governor Culver is looking to the president to help us. Once the president gives a declaration, then we get financial help from FEMA. And that's really what we need.
Mm-hmm. And to find out more about these disaster declarations now, I'm joined by Dave Miller, the administrator of Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He joins us from our Iowa Public Radio studios in Des Moines. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Alex. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, in broad terms, Mihaela Cox in Warren County explained what a difference between a state and presidential disaster declaration would do. But just broadly now, explain how state programs are going to help communities in Iowa.
Well, I want to start a little bit at the beginning. As Mihaela said, a lot of the disasters we're having, a lot of those impacts happen locally first. But when it grows beyond their ability to either respond or to recover from the effects of the disaster, they'll often ask for a governor's proclamation. And as Mihaela reported, that can come in the way of resources, as she suggested, from the Department of Transportation or National Guard or the Department of Public Safety or others. But it also provides some technical assistance if that's needed. And then one key program started a number of years ago called the State Individual Assistance Program. And as Mihaela talked about, that program is for what we say as Iowans most in need. It's those that are within 200% of the federal poverty level. And then those are grants for losses to personal property up to $5,000. Again, they're not intended to make people whole, but it is intended to help those that may be most in need and to help them get back on their feet.
Mm-hmm. And as Mihaela Cox said, the certain assistance that can be applied to the individuals are for lower income people, which wouldn't really help the main population. You said 200% above the poverty level. Try to describe what that really means.
Well, I'd have to look at the income guidelines that are put out, and they'll change every year based on consumer price. But the Department of Human Services administers the program, and there are some income limits there for individuals and for families. And I don't want to be misquoted on it, but I think an individual's income is relatively low, below $20,000.
So a lot of people can't really benefit from that. Is there a thought to maybe try to broaden that out so more people could benefit? Or would that kind of assistance maybe come with a presidential disaster declaration?
Well, I think as we gain experience in the individual assistance area, we'll see changes in that law. And we've seen changes since it first came into force a couple of years ago. When it was first enacted, it was those that were within 100% of federal poverty. Now we've moved to 200%. Grants were originally at $3,500. Now they're at $5,000. And I think as we gain perspective on what's needed, who's most in need, how these disasters can be, how folks recover from them, we'll get an idea of where to go. Part of the design of the Iowa program, we're only one of a few states that has an individual assistance program, is to really bridge a gap between the local need when we have a smaller type disaster and when the governor may ask for a presidential declaration and their individual and family assistance programs.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about what's done on the county level. Turning to you, Mihaela Cox, in Warren County, what kinds of evidence do you need to collect when you're trying to put together an application for either a state or federal disaster declaration?
Well, it is a process, and we basically have to show that we, number one, have damage beyond what we can locally take care of. Like, all disasters are local, so we start with the emergency response and take care of that. But when it gets beyond our capabilities or my budget to help people out, then I, of course, call Dave's shop and get some assistance. So we have to gather rock-solid information about who has damage, how much it is it covered by insurance, and very precise descriptions of the damage for the individuals. And for the public assistance, the infrastructure, we have to do the same thing. We have to have very precise numbers so that when we give, we can paint an accurate picture to Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management to kind of prove our case that we're a little in over our head at the local level.
Mm-hmm. So is this a matter of local people going out in the community, some state people, and touring the damage? What would that assessment look like?
Well, We do it locally first to get the data to provide to the state people, and then we can request to Dave's shop a joint assessment, and the state and, in some cases, the federal FEMA people will come to my county, and we'll all get together, and we'll go around, and we'll physically look at the damage and interview the citizens and work with the county engineer and the conservation people, so because you know, our parks take a hit, too, our bike trails and those kind of things, and they all have to be repaired simply for public safety, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. So it is a long process, and it is labor-intensive, but it's well worth it to get the help that we can for the citizens.
So really, recovery wouldn't be feasible without assistance from the state or the federal government?
It's very difficult. It would definitely extend the time frame that we could get back to what we would consider normal working.
Mm-hmm. How does what's going on in Warren County, and it's not just Warren County, it's as I said at the beginning of the show, it's more than 30 counties throughout the state, but how does what's going on in Warren County compare to other disasters that have possibly been there before?
Unfortunately, we've had a lot of disasters in my tenure in emergency management, and they all have their similarities, but every disaster is different, and the policies and procedures change from time to time, so you have to really keep up on what FEMA wants, what the Iowa Homeland Security, what information they want, so that you're not, you know, gathering double duty or doing extra work, because it's, like I said, labor-intensive, so we have to make sure that we communicate well back and forth between all levels of government so we can best serve our citizens.
How often would you say those rules and regulations change?
Sometimes from disaster to disaster. So it's just an education process and a good communication between all levels of government just so that we can get on board and get things moving as quickly as possible, because sometimes the wheels move a little slower than we would like. But it is a process, and it's a process that is tried and true. So, you know, there's disasters all over the country, and FEMA works them all over the country. So they learn from mistakes, and they update their procedures occasionally.
All right. I've been joined by Mihaela Cox, the Emergency Management Coordinator for Warren County, which is just south of Des Moines. Thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome. If I could impose for just one second, Dave.
Very quickly.
Dave Miller has some very good information on Iowa Homeland Security's website for citizens that want to go on the website and learn more about disasters.
Great. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about when we come back from the break. More with Dave Miller. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. We're back in about a minute. And we're back with The Exchange here on Iowa Public Radio. Today we're talking about disaster declarations in the state. More than a third of Iowa's 99 counties are under a disaster proclamation, and about just as many are under consideration by the president to be a presidential declared disaster area. So I'm continuing my conversation for about the next 10 minutes or so with Dave Miller. He's the administrator of Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Dave, talk to me a little bit about the criteria. How is it decided whether a county or a particular community will become a disaster area?
Well, in terms of a governor's proclamation, there is no official threshold. So when the local government, going through their county emergency management coordinator, determines that it's beyond their capability, they've executed mutual aid to the extent that they can, then they may request a governor's proclamations, and those are usually pretty forthcoming. We respond immediately. Even if the governor is gone, we have a way to contact him, get the verbal authorization, and follow up with the paperwork. So that happens relatively quickly. Presidential declaration requests are a little bit slower process, and as Mihaela alluded, they're really driven by a damage assessment. When we look at those, we look at those in terms of individuals and families, businesses, then damages to public infrastructure, and even damages to agriculture.
Mm-hmm. And so We were earlier talking about the individual assistance, which can be the $5,000 reimbursement. I understand that there's going to be a change in this program to perhaps a voucher program.
Well, effective July 1st, legislature changed it to a voucher-type system. We'll be working, as will local governments, be working with the Department of Human Services to have administrative rules adopted to implement that program. But in the meantime, they'll be looking at the voucher system and then extending the program the way it's administered now to ensure that there isn't a gap in the service that we can supply to Iowans.
So what's really the difference between a reimbursement program or a voucher program? How would that affect the individuals?
Well, the way we think it affects them the most, with the problem that we've run into the program the way we first executed it, it is a reimbursement program. So you're already taking the poorest of Iowans, those within 200% of federal poverty, and you're telling them to go out and invest the money, get their receipts, and wait for a reimbursement. That became problematic. Now, we've worked with faith-based and community organizations to fill that gap and then to reimburse through that method, but it was awkward at best. The voucher system allows them to go out and get the estimate, get the voucher, pay the cost up front, and to do more upfront work with and get their money quicker and be able to recover quicker from the effects of the disaster.
About how many people have requested this assistance to date from these recent storms and the rain that Iowa has had?
Boy, I'd have to go back and look at the Department of Human Services. What we plan on in order to fund the program, because it goes to the legislature for funding every year, that gets authorized through the State Executive Council. We try to plan on about two disasters a year, two to three, where we have a number of folks involved, try to allocate and look at maybe $1 million into that fund. One of the gaps that we're trying to fill overall, it really has to do with the public assistance side. In order to get a presidential disaster declaration, we're looking at a couple thresholds. On the individual and family side, even though there isn't an official one that the federal government follows, matter of fact, they're prohibited from establishing a threshold for individuals and families, but they'll look at a guideline. The guideline is 100 homes with 50% or greater uninsured loss. So we're trying to fill that gap a little bit with the state IA program. On the public assistance side, then there are some thresholds to be met. And bottom line there, statewide, we're looking at about a $4.5 to $5 million disaster before it's really feasible for the governor to make his request to the president.
Mm-hmm. And with those presidential disaster declarations, you were saying that that's a bit longer of a timeline than the state ones declared by the governor. So when would you hope that President Obama could approve those presidential disaster declarations?
Well, we had hoped that we'd hear within a couple of days of the governor making his request. Sometimes those processes have taken longer. I've seen them take up to 30 days. And in an Iowa City tornado a few years ago, it took the federal government more than 30 days to tell us no. And that halts processes. If I don't get the FEMA declaration, if the governor doesn't get the presidential declaration, then there are some alternatives. He may ask for a Small Business Administration designation that turns on low-interest loan programs. For farmers, he may ask for a USDA, a Secretary of Ag, designation that turns on loan programs for farmers. So there are alternatives, but one of the more comprehensive ways is to ask for the presidential. The problem is programs get put on hold until we get an answer to that question and whether the president grants his request or not.
You mentioned that in previous disasters it took 30 days just to get a no. How often are these presidential disaster declarations approved for the state of Iowa typically in your experience?
Well, I've been with the agency about 21 years, and I can only recall maybe two or three times where we've been denied a request. Part of that is, as Mihaela said, is the intensive process that you go through in producing the damage assessment reports. She talked about a joint preliminary damage assessment with FEMA and the state, and it involves local governments. That effort is to identify the cost to the programs. When we talk about damage assessment, we're really talking about it in terms of, are the programs needed? Have we met thresholds if the thresholds are there? Do we have a good indicator that the program will go into effect? So if we do an adequate damage assessment, we have a fairly high degree of certainty that we're going to have our request granted. The ones that are really marginal are those where we don't meet the guideline. For instance, an individual assistance program where we don't have 100 homes with 50% or greater uninsured loss. And frankly, right now, the disaster the governor is asking for, made the request last week, is marginal in that case. What we have to add to that are the long-term effects. And as Mihaela said, this isn't a case where we've had one disaster and this is the first one in the last 2 or 3 years. This is a case where we've had areas of the state affected time and time again over a 3- and 4-year period. They haven't fully recovered from the previous disaster, and yet they have another one that impacts them. We need to make the case for that with the president. The numbers, if that's all they looked at, were marginal. So we try to make a stronger case and put it in the context of events that have happened over a longer period of time.
Does what's happening throughout the country affect whether Iowa would get a presidential disaster declaration? In other words, if there are a lot of disasters throughout the country, would that make it less likely that a disaster declaration would be granted to this state?
Well, I don't think it plays directly into that. I've never seen a case where, because there was a disaster in California or Florida or Louisiana, where the state's been denied their request. That's not usually the cause and effect. What we have seen forever is this. For instance, this year right now, the Disaster Recovery Fund that needed a supplemental, the supplemental hasn't been approved by Congress. That means people recovering from previous disasters, not so much individuals, but governments recovering from that. That money is frozen. If we're looking at mitigation programs where we're doing property acquisitions, buying structures and removing them from the floodplain, a lot of that money is frozen. So there is an effect there. If they overspend or deplete the disaster recovery fund, then things get put on stop for a while till Congress passes supplemental legislation that replenishes the fund.
We keep seeing just yesterday there was an update. A new county, I believe it was Fayette County, was added to a state disaster declaration. How likely do you think it is that more counties in these coming days will be added to the governor's proclamation?
Well, right now our incident period is open. Mihaela talked about events happening since June 1st. And what we do in the governor's proclamation is talk about events happening June 1st or after and continuing, because we really haven't broken this storm cycle yet. This morning, we had a request from Shelby County, and we're acting on that, and again, to turn on the state individual assistance program there. And as we continue to have storms and severe heavy rains, as we've experienced even in smaller areas, and the fact that floodwaters haven't completely left the state, we may get more requests for assistance. It's hard to anticipate that now, but it seems like every day we get one or two counties to add on to that governor's proclamation.
You said that some of the damage throughout the state is marginal. In about a minute or so, how does what's happening in the state now compare to previous years?
Well, first of all, when I say it's marginal in terms of the numbers we have. It certainly isn't marginal to the citizens that are affected. And we've seen a number of citizens whose homes have been destroyed or have major damages. And when I compare it to others, certainly we've had storms in the past. We've had flood events in the past where many more citizens were affected. 2008 is an example. 1993 is an example. But there are other ones where we've had significant individual assistance damages in the state. 96 was a high flood year, I think, again in 2000 or 2001. And we see that repeatedly, but nothing like we saw in 2008. It was a historic event for Iowans and affected many, many of them. More than 3,000 individuals and families were affected.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Dave Miller, Administrator of Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on the program, we'll talk about more about disaster declarations. This is Iowa Public Radio. We're back with the exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, we're talking about disaster declarations in Iowa. More than a third of Iowa's 99 counties are under a state disaster proclamation because of the recent storms and flooding. About just as many counties are on a list under consideration to be declared a presidential disaster area. I'm joined now by Bill Brock, the director of the Consumer Protection Division at the Iowa Attorney General's Office. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
In a moment, we're going to be talking about anti-price gouging rules. But in the meantime, tell us your stories of price gouging during a disaster. Has a business tried to cheat you during a time of need? Or has a business maybe been more generous than expected? Share your recovery stories with us. Give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Before I talk to Bill Brock, we're going to get this update from another disaster-affected community in Iowa. We're going now to Butler County, which is just northwest of Waterloo. Mitch Nordmeyer is the Emergency Management Coordinator for Butler County. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm also joined by Dwayne Wubenau, owner of Dumont Implement on Highway 3 in Dumont. Thank you for being with us today. Mr. Wubenau, are you with us? All right, we don't have him with us right now. Mitch Nordmeyer, Emergency Management Coordinator in Butler County. Talk a little bit about the damage in Butler County.
The West Fork of the Cedar River is one of the rivers that runs through Butler County. We had considerable flooding, a flash flooding in the city of Dumont. Over about a third of the homes were affected. The water came up very quickly, and we really didn't have a lot of time to sandbag. It was more evacuation and getting people out than it was trying to do any type of mitigation. And then that river flows all the way across the county, so naturally we had a concern of all of the farm people that live in the rural areas, livestock, you know, their homes. So it basically started at one side of the county and went all the way to the other side.
Mm-hmm. So give me an idea of about maybe how many people or how many businesses that was.
In the city of Dumont itself, there was five businesses affected and about 25 homes. And then we had probably 8 or 10 more homes out in the rural area, and then another little town just north of there received, a lot of people had water in their basements in the city of Ardale. So I think we had a total of 50 homes altogether that were affected.
Mm. Now, after the tornadoes of 2008, I understand that there was an emergency center that was set up in Butler County, but that closed right before this recent round of bad weather. Is that right?
The Long-Term Disaster Recovery Coalition has done just a marvelous job. Matter of fact, Rebuild Iowa organization is going to honor them next Tuesday with an award. But they finally decided, they kind of had everything wrapped up, and about a week or 10 days before this last round of flooding, they decided to become dormant. And now all of a sudden, I believe they're going to ramp up again.
Mm. So that they will restart the center there.
Yeah, they'll be able to try and help some of these people that have been flooded. We've already got a disaster declaration from the state, which allows people that meet certain income levels to obtain up to $5,000 through the state of Iowa assistance. And now we're just waiting to see if we get a federal proclamation.
Mm-hmm. And how will Butler County benefit by the reopening of this emergency center?
Well, it allows people to of any income levels to make application to get some additional funding to try and replace some of the items that they may have lost, which may or may not have been covered by insurance. And if we don't get a federal proclamation, the assistance money is pretty limited, so it's another avenue for them to try and get some money to replace some of their lost items.
Mm-hmm. Dwayne Wubenau, owner of Dumont Implement, are you with us now? Okay, I apologize. We weren't able to get with Dwayne today. But Mitch, I understand that his business was one of those flood-affected businesses there.
Yeah, it was. Matter of fact, I think he had customers at the parts counter when the Dumont firefighters went in and said, grab what you can and get out. The water's coming. He's right on Highway 3. And he had, probably 14 to 16 inches of water running through his parts department. So he had a number of of parts bins that had water in them, plus all of his equipment that was stored outside. There was no time to get any of that up out of the water. So Dwayne did have some flood insurance, which is going to help, but it was, you know, it was a pretty large cleanup for his business.
All right. Mitch Nordmeyer, Emergency Management Coordinator in Butler County, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us that update.
Thank you for having me.
I'm joined now, as I said at the beginning of this second half of the show, by Bill Brock. He's the director of the Consumer Protection Division at the Iowa Attorney General's Office. Thank you again for being here today.
You're welcome.
So I understand now that there are certain rules that take effect when there is a disaster proclamation, anti-price gouging rules. Explain what that is.
Well, it all started in 1993 with the floods then when we got some good advice, I think, from the Florida Attorney General's office. They had just been through Hurricane Andrew. And they said, you know, there are going to be individuals who are going to show up in the communities here in Iowa, and they're going to really gouge people for things they need, like water, food, sanitation, and maybe even temporary housing. And you need to do something to take care of that. And we have the Consumer Fraud Act, our primary consumer protection law. It's a civil statute that the state enforces. And we have rulemaking authority, the ability of the Attorney General's office to adopt what are, in essence, like laws that have the force and effect of law, their rules. And so we adopted a rule that goes into effect whenever the governor or president declares a county a disaster. And it says that you cannot charge more than you were charging before the onset of the disaster for those kinds of items that consumers really need, unless your costs have gone up. So if you have a kind of an excessive price, an unreasonable hike in price for food, for water, for medicine, whatever it might be, because of the disaster, because of the disruption in the normal market forces, that's an unfair practice under the Consumer Fraud Act, and it's illegal. And so what we try to do is get the word out to the communities, both to the businesses there and to consumers, to be alert to that and for the businesses to avoid imposing those extra charges, those higher prices, and for consumers, if they do incur that, if they see that, to report it to the Attorney General's office.
Mm-hmm. We want to reach out to our listeners, to you, the listener. Tell us your stories of price gouging during a disaster. Have you maybe been affected by these recent storms and rain and noticed that prices are higher on certain items? Share your recovery stories with us. Give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Bill Brock, are there any circumstances under which a business could increase their price during a disaster?
Certainly, if their costs increase, then they can pass that along. In other words, if they keep the same markup, the same margin on the retail product, then that really isn't doing anything untoward because their costs have gone up as well. So that's a fair thing to do. And you know, once the disaster is over and the market disruption is over and the normal forces of the marketplace of demand and supply are in play, then there really isn't a concern. Generally, we don't have laws in this country against charging prices that are too high for a particular product unless it's a regulated type of product like utilities, for example.
Mm-hmm. And In thinking about supply and demand, the whole idea, one of the ideas behind a business is that when demand increases, that the price could increase too. That why should that not be the case?
In the context of a disaster emergency, we don't really look at it as Christmas for retailers. The whole notion here is that people need these products. And supplies are going to be limited, so you don't take this opportunity to take further advantage of people who are already hurting. And there really is no advantage to the marketplace in allowing that kind of conduct. We don't want to ration out food and medicine to whoever has the most money. We want it to be available to people. And it would be fair, for example, for a retailer to limit quantities or something of that nature. But to hike the price to take advantage of the situation is totally unfair. And quite frankly, it's something we've come not to expect from Iowa retailers. Iowa retailers generally are not going to treat their customers that way. They live in the community. And, you know, those may be their friends or relatives, might be the next customer standing in line. And so the bottom line is they've got a reputation to uphold if they're going to continue to be able to do business in that community. So they're not going to do that. But, you know, most retailers are not mom-and-pop stores anymore. They're national companies or international corporations and may not have the same kind of sense of responsibility. And so rules like this, I think, are important. And when we get the word out in advance, it usually deters any conduct that would violate the law. But on occasion, we do see some violations.
Have you seen any violations during this recent bad weather?
We've had a couple of reports. One relates to insect repellent and a retailer that increased the price. And we're waiting to get the details in writing from the consumer. And we've been in contact with her since she first contacted us to try to encourage us to get us the information we need so that we can check that out. That allegation related to an adjoining county, one that wasn't subject to a disaster declaration, but the retailer owns several locations, including some that are in counties that are covered by disaster declaration. So we would want to, in fact, check that out and make sure that did not occur. If it did, then we'll be dealing with the retailer on that situation. Another call came in relating to a home improvement problem and some allegations that a contractor took money from a consumer and did not complete the work and is refusing to finish the work. That's not so much price gouging as it is kind of common home improvement fraud. And those do increase in number, those kinds of complaints in the wake of a flood. So given that the waters are just receding in a number of places, given that consumers, homeowners need some time for their homes to be cleared of debris and dry out before they begin repairs, if we do get complaints, we may be seeing those in coming weeks as opposed to during the time that the floods are occurring.
But now you're not really noticing any statewide trends or at least trends in the disaster-declared counties.
No, we are not, and we are obviously quite pleased about that. We are not seeing any trends. But, again, we encourage consumers to contact us. The information we have comes from people who call us or email us and let us know what's happening. And they can call us. We have a toll-free number, 888-777-4590. Again, 888-777-4590. And you can file a complaint online as well at iowaattorneygeneral.gov. Just click on Protecting Consumers and you'll see our online complaint form. But again, iowaattorneygeneral.gov, all spelled out.
Mm-hmm. And what are the penalties for businesses that you would find would violate the anti-price gouging rule?
If they violate the rule, it is per se a violation of the Iowa Consumer Fraud Act, and that's a law that allows us to sue a violator in court and seek restitution for consumers, so monetary reimbursement, civil penalties up to $40,000 per violation. That's the maximum. Wouldn't necessarily be $40,000, plus attorney fees and costs for the state and court orders, injunctive relief, stopping the illegal practice.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that some businesses can increase the price if their costs go up as well. That would seem like a very gray area, maybe hard to pin that exactly down, hard to enforce.
Well, it could be in a close case. Obviously, we're going to have discretion to determine which we think are pretty obvious violations. And so, as with any situation, we'll want to hear the business's side of the story. And provide an opportunity for that business to give us any information that it has to justify its conduct, and then we'll take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain kinds of practices, unscrupulous practices, that are more common during a disaster? You mentioned that there were certain items like food, water, and medicine that mm-hmm. would be in high demand, but is there a certain practice or a service maybe?
There really is one that creates more problems during recovery from a weather disaster than it normally does, and it normally is a fairly frequent complaint, and that is home improvement. in disasters, you will have individuals or companies from out of state that will show up in the area and go door to door and offer their services. And there have been a number of problems with those kinds of individuals or entities where they take money for people and do very little work or very shoddy work, and then they're gone. And or they may misstate the price. They may do work. It may even be quality work, but then they're charging double what they said they would. And very often consumers who are in distress and are in a hurry to get shelter and to have their homes repaired maybe do things that they wouldn't normally do. They may say, yes, I'll give you that money in advance without even signing a contract or without that contract being specific about what kind of work is being done and who's doing it and whether the consumer is going to be liable to subcontractors as well or whether the consumer is going to get what's called a lien waiver. So if you pay the general contractor, you're not liable to the subcontractors if the general contractor fails to pay them off. So there are those kinds of things that happen, and we strongly encourage consumers to work with local contractors, if at all possible, and in any event, to check out those contractors with our office and with the Better Business Bureau to see if complaints are on file, and finally, to check with the Iowa Department of Workforce Development. They have a labor contractor registration requirement, and we would discourage anybody from doing business with a contractor that is not registered with the Iowa Workforce Development Department. And you can get that information online by going to iowaworkforce.org/labor. And then you click on contractor registration, and then you click on the database, and you just type in the name of the contractor and find out if they are if they're properly registered.
Is it more difficult to prosecute a one of those unscrupulous businesses that come in from out of state?
It is. It's harder to catch them because sometimes they hit a community and then they are gone by the time anybody in law enforcement even finds out they were there. And so it is very, very important for consumers to be the first line of defense and to know who they're doing business with, to get contracts in writing, and if there is any sense of trouble, to report it to local police and to the Attorney General's office so that we can check it out. And hopefully, if there's a problem, we'll be able to take action while those contractors are still in the state.
If you're just joining us, my guest now is Bill Brock, the director of the Consumer Protection Division at the Iowa Attorney General's Office. We're talking about anti-price gouging rules in Iowa, as more than a third of Iowa's counties are under a disaster declaration because of these recent storms and rains that we have had. How often have complaints been filed in the past? You mentioned that there hasn't been so many this time around, but how often in the past? What is coming to mind right now is the disasters of 2008.
2008, we were somewhat surprised we didn't get a great number of complaints. We got a few complaints relating to home improvement fraud. We did get some complaints after onset of the floods, maybe 6 or 7 months later, from some business owners, some building owners who had concerns about companies that they thought were local but were not local, that they had very large contracts with to do cleanup and abatement of the water problems that the buildings had incurred, and thought that they were being price gouged. Those ended up in private litigation, and from our viewpoint, they were best dealt with in those private lawsuits about, in fact, whether the work actually had been done. So there were allegations of price gouging. It looked like to us that the issues were not so much price gouging as whether, in fact, the work that was done was that which was contracted for by those building owners. Back in 93, we had complaints and valid complaints about price gouging. Individuals who were driving through neighborhoods with gallons of water in the backs of pickup trucks, selling them for $5 a gallon, exorbitant prices today, much less 17 years ago. Also, proven allegations of price gouging in the sale or rental of generators that folks needed, and we were able to deal with those. Also, portable toilets. Back then, there were companies that were charging above normal rates for rental of porta potties. So You never know where the complaints are going to come from in these contexts. Fortunately, we have not had the problems that some places like Florida have had in the context of price gouging, and perhaps part of it was being able to get on top of it right away and deter it with having this rule in place and doing a lot of public education, both retailers and consumers, about the existence and application of that rule.
We have just about a minute left of the program. One example that comes to mind, there were people in Cedar Rapids after the floods of 2008 that complained, people who were forced out of their home that complained that apartments were raising their rents. Is that something that your office would handle?
Yes. In fact, I'm not aware of that having happened in 08, so that's interesting to hear that we did not receive complaints to that effect, but that is something that would be covered by the rule. You know, the demand for housing goes up when you've had damaged property, and again, it's not intended to be an opportunity for landlords to take advantage of the situation and make more money. So to the extent that something like that might happen, say, in Butler County right now, we would want to know about it, and we would strongly encourage anyone who has that happen to them to contact us. Absolutely.
And very quickly, how can people contact your office if they suspect anti-price gouging?
Call us or email us, 888-777-4590 in Des Moines, 281-5926 is our direct number. But outside of the Des Moines local calling area, call our toll-free number.
Okay, very good. Bill Brock, Director of the Consumer Protection Division at the Iowa Attorney General's Office, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange is available at iowapublicradio.org. And we welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer.
And for the